Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we've got a really critical mission. We're going to dive into asset protection, specifically those strategies you usually only hear about the super rich using. We want to figure out how you, the middle class earner, can actually leverage them. We're basically mapping out the lifeboats here, drawing from this really interesting source, Money Alchemy, Asset Protection for the Middle Class. And the author starts with this, well, this powerful metaphor, maybe a bit alarming too. They say we're all kind of aboard Uncle Sam's Titanic, you know, that American belief in solid financial ground. Like the actual Titanic, they argue it's maybe an illusion.
It's a strong way to start, yeah. And they back it up pretty quickly with the context. I mean, you look at the U.S. national debt, right? Mm-hmm. As of 2025, it's over $37 trillion. That's huge. And it's not just a number on a page. It represents this slow kind of creeping erosion of financial stability. It affects everyone holding assets here. So the idea is if you want to protect yourself, you need to realize the ship might actually be taking on water. Our job today, find those lifeboats the source talks about, help you figure out a safer course.
Okay, right. So let's unpack that. Why does it feel like the middle class is always, you know, pushing that boulder uphill, like Sisyphus? The source points to some pretty big constraints.
Yeah.
You've got roughly a 31% federal income tax rate.
Yeah.
And that's before everything else.
Exactly. Before state, local, self-employment taxes.
Yeah.
And then layer on these just astronomical living costs. I mean, the source mentions a basic 3-bedroom place in the Bay Area costing over $1 million. How do you save and build wealth with that kind of pressure? It feels almost unsustainable.
Yeah. Really tough.
And that leads directly to the source's main point. Truly effective, like guaranteed asset protection. Basically doesn't exist within North America. Think about it. The government takes its third, the state takes its slice. You're already playing catch up. But the real ticker, the thing that puts the squeeze on, is the massive liability exposure you face just by living here.
Financially vulnerable right out of the gate, essentially.
Pretty much, before you even start a business or, heck, drive your car.
Okay, so that brings us to the first big hazard we need to talk about. This pervasive threat of litigation.
Oh, it's staggering. It really is. Legal risks aren't just for doctors or big company owners anymore, not by a long shot. There's data from international firms suggesting the average American, they have about a 33% chance of being sued sometime in their life.
Yeah, 1 in 3.
1 in 3. Think about the people you know. 1 out of every 3 facing serious legal action.
It's a lot. And here's where the source gets really interesting, I think. It mentions a 2001 Business Week piece that called litigation in America less of a justice system and more like an assembly line.
An assembly line. That's a powerful image.
Yeah, and it's an assembly line churning out huge money. Personal injury claims alone, $57.3 billion in revenue for lawyers back in 2024. That kind of money flow just drives up costs for everyone else, right? Like the example of a doctor's malpractice insurance.
Right. You see it there clearly, maybe $10,000, $15,000 back in 1990. Now, a GP might be shelling out $50,000 or more just for basic coverage. The stakes just keep getting higher.
So it's not just the obvious lawsuits either. You mentioned these sort of hidden threats.
Exactly. These are the ones that can really blindside you. First, you've got SLAPP suits. Strategic lawsuits against public participation. These aren't really about winning in court. They're designed purely to harass, to intimidate, to bankrupt someone into silence.
Like that blueberry farmer example.
Yeah, the West Virginia farmer. All he did was report pollution from a mining company. What happens? He gets hit with a $200,000 lawsuit. Just crushed him. Or the League of Women Voters facing a $63 million suit simply for sending a couple of critical letters about a condo project. It's using the legal system as a weapon.
That's chilling.
Yeah.
But the other one you flagged, the Anti-Drug Act of 1988, that sounds even more, well, terrifying from a vulnerability standpoint.
It is terrifying because it kind of sidesteps basic due process in a way. This law lets authorities temporarily seize your stuff, your house, your car, your bank accounts, not based on proof, but on suspicion about someone connected to you.
Like a relative or even just an associate.
Right. Let's say, you know, a cousin crashes in your basement for a bit and unknown to you, they're selling something illegal. Boom. Authorities can freeze your entire financial life. Instantly. You're suddenly broke, scrambling to hire lawyers, trying desperately to prove you had no clue what was going on. You lose everything first, then you fight to get it back.
Okay, wow. That paints a really stark picture of the risks just living here. So, okay, before we jump onto that offshore lifeboat, the source does outline some domestic moves first, right? What are those? Like maximizing protection here at home first.
Exactly. You need these domestic defenses. They're like necessary speed bumps, you know, even if they aren't the final answer. So rule number one, absolutely non-negotiable, be really careful about joint relationships. This is maybe the easiest way people trip themselves up.
How so? What's the common mistake there?
Well, most people think, okay, I'm a 25% partner in this little venture, so I'm only on the hook for 25% of any problems. That's just wrong, fundamentally wrong. Often, a creditor can go after the entire asset if it's jointly owned. You could end up 100% responsible for losses from something you only owned a small piece of.
So, if my spouse and I own our house together, or we have a joint checking account,
Yeah.
those could be grabbed by a creditor chasing my business partner's debt.
Precisely. That joint ownership creates a bridge for liability to cross. It makes the whole asset fair game, as you said. That's why the source really pushes things like nuptial agreements, prenups, even postnups. Clearly defining who owns what is key to blocking that co-ownership liability.
Okay, that makes sense. Rule number two is about structure, using corporations wisely. We hear LLCs and CORs thrown around a lot. What's the practical magic for our listener?
The magic is separation. Simple as that. An LLC, a limited liability company, or a corporation. Its whole purpose is to create a legal wall between the owner, that's you, and the business's money, and crucially, its liabilities. If the company gets sued, usually your personal assets are safe. That separation is your shield. And the really smart advice here is to set up multiple entities, not just one.
Okay, why multiple?
You use one, say a corporation, for your high-risk activities, the actual business operations, the stuff that might attract a lawsuit. Then you use a completely separate entity, maybe a limited partnership, to hold your safe, low-risk assets, like your investment property, maybe some equipment. You still control everything, but legally, you don't own the valuable stuff in a way that a creditor can easily snatch.
Got it. And rule three kind of builds on that. Diversify assets.
Yeah, diversify ownership across different structures. Don't just put all your eggs in one basket, legally speaking. Maybe an LP holds the property, an LLC holds the business gear, cash is sitting in a trust. If someone comes after you with a judgment, they don't just hit one target, they have to fight through this maze. Sue each separate entity. It's slow, it's expensive. You make yourself a much less attractive target.
Right, make it not worth the effort. So these are good domestic defenses, solid speed bumps. But you mentioned this kind of brutal bottom line. No domestic plan is foolproof if the government really wants your assets. Why is that limitation so absolute?
It's absolute because of jurisdiction. U.S. courts rule over everything you own inside the U.S., period. If the government thinks IRS, DOJ, whoever, or even a really motivated creditor gets a court order against you, you have to comply. Or you're looking at contempt charges, possibly jail time, the source is blunt. If the U.S. government decides it wants your domestic assets, it will take them. Domestic structures, no matter how clever, can't hide from domestic law. And that realization is what pushes us inevitably towards the ultimate protection, going offshore. Specifically, the Offshore Asset Protection Trust, the ATP.
That's the real life boat then. Okay, let's talk offshore. First, let's clear up the image.
Offshore sounds kind of shadowy. Maybe tropical islands?
Yeah, people often picture the Caymans or something, and those are
Yeah.
options, sure.
Yeah.
But the source defines offshore much more simply. It just means any jurisdiction that isn't your home country.
Yeah.
So that could be Luxembourg, Singapore, Switzerland, not just the Caribbean.
Okay. And what about the fear people might have? Like, are you cutting yourself off economically, becoming isolated? That's a common fear, but the source says it's largely unfounded. Doing business offshore these days, it's pretty much the same as doing it domestically, technologically speaking, but you gain huge advantages. Better geographic diversification for your wealth, and crucially, real asset protection that your local courts back home can't easily
Nah,
pierce.
this isn't just for the billionaires, right? That myth needs busting. You mentioned the Judy Cathy
Oh,
example.
Judy Cathy, it's a fantastic example from the source. A single mom, right? She had her kids' first year college fund. Instead of dumping it in the stock market, which felt risky, she used it strategically, got a private banking license in the British Virgin Islands. A legitimate license. She then used that to facilitate proper legal international transactions. And the result? Reportedly, a seven-figure net profit, we're talking millions. It shows what's possible for someone financially savvy, even starting relatively small.
That's incredible, and it ties into this geographic reality the source highlights.
It really does. Think about it. The U.S. is only about one-sixth of the world's landmass, just one piece of the puzzle. But the source states that 80%, 80% of the world's financial and investment opportunities are actually offshore, outside the US. So if you're serious about diversifying, especially, with concerns about the dollar's value long term, can you really afford to ignore four-fifths of the global economy?
That's a powerful statistic. So for someone listening who's maybe feeling a bit nervous about all this, what's a low-risk first step?
The source suggests something really simple. Just open a basic offshore bank account. You can often do it with as little as $100, maybe up to $1,000. It's a small step, low commitment.
And what's the immediate practical upside, besides just having some money outside the U.S. system?
Well, stability and insulation are key. You're moving a small slice of your wealth into a potentially stronger, maybe more conservatively regulated banking system. You get instant geographic diversification for that portion of your money. It's protected from those sudden domestic freezes we talked about earlier, like with the Anti-Drug Act. Plus, there's a small side benefit the source calls float time. Checks drawn on an offshore account often take maybe 2 weeks longer to clear. That money earns interest for you just a little bit longer. It's minor, but it's something.
Okay, so that's dipping a toe in the water. Now, the main event, the Asset Protection Trust, the ATP, how does this thing actually put assets totally beyond the reach of a U.S. court?
Okay, so the ATP, if it's set up correctly and maintained properly, is based in a foreign country chosen specifically for its strong trust protection laws. The key elements are: the trustee is foreign, the assets are legally held and controlled offshore. Now, if a creditor back in the U.S. gets a judgment against you personally, that judgment doesn't automatically reach the trust assets. The creditor has to go to the foreign court where the trust is based and essentially start their lawsuit all over again, trying to convince that court to break into the trust. And the ATP's built-in features make that incredibly difficult, often impossible.
Right. Those protective provisions. Let's break those down. The first one you mentioned is the anti-duress provision.
Correct. This is crucial. It's designed to counter a U.S. judge trying to force you, the person who set up the trust, the grantor, to bring the assets back home. Let's say a judge says, bring that money back or I'll hold you in contempt, maybe jail you. The trust document itself explicitly states the foreign trustee is forbidden from complying with any instructions given under duress. If the trustee sees you're being legally threatened, their duty might be to freeze the assets or even move them, not give them back. It neuters the judge's coercive power over you regarding the trust assets.
Okay. Then there's the spendthrift clause that just stops the trustee being reckless with the money, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Standard trust stuff protects the assets from the beneficiary's own potential mismanagement, too. But the third one, the transfer of status provision. That sounds like the real game changer for mobility.
You called it the ATP's secret weapon.
It really is. This provision gives the foreign trustee the power to instantly, like with the flip of a switch, change the trust's legal home, its situs, and move all its assets legally to another country if trouble is brewing.
Hold on, situs. Can you just clarify that simply for everyone listening?
Oh, sure. Yeah, situs just means the official legal location or seat of the trust, where it legally exists according to the law. So imagine your trust's legal office is currently in Belize. The transfer of status provision is like an emergency eject button. If the trustee detects a creditor making serious moves in Belize, or maybe lawsuit looks imminent there, they can trigger this clause. And instantly, legally, the trust's situs and all its assets might jump to, say, the Cook Islands. The creditor, who might have spent months and a fortune filing suit in Belize, suddenly they're completely back to square one. They have to start the whole expensive, difficult process over again in a brand new country, often one with even tougher laws. It's like the trust just vanished legally.
Wow. Okay, that explains why picking the right host country is so incredibly important. Where does the source recommend looking? Countries with laws strong enough to basically ignore foreign judgments.
You need jurisdictions that genuinely treat the trust as its own separate legal person, totally independent from the person who created it. The classic, well-regarded options often mentioned are places like the British Virgin Islands, the Cayman Islands, Belize. These have long histories in this area. But if you want to compare the sort of top-tier options, the source highlights.
Okay, let's do that. Start with the Cook Islands. They keep coming up as the gold standard for pure defense.
They really are seen that way. The Cook Islands arguably have the strongest asset protection trust laws anywhere in the world. Critically, their courts simply do not recognize judgments from foreign courts, like the U.S. A creditor must relitigate the entire case from scratch under Cook Islands law. Plus, they have a very short statute of limitations, sometimes just 1 or 2 years, for a creditor to even bring a claim regarding the transfer into the trust. And the burden of proof on that creditor is incredibly high, like beyond a reasonable doubt in some cases.
Yeah.
So if your absolute top priority is pure wealth defense, walling off assets from future potential legal trouble, the Cook Islands are hard to beat.
Okay. Then there's Singapore. Sounds different. Less about being impenetrable, maybe more about reputation.
Exactly. Singapore is often the choice when credibility and stability are paramount, especially if you plan to run active international business operations through your offshore structures. It's known globally for transparency, a strong rule of law, a very stable environment. Plus, it offers attractive tax benefits. Corporate tax is capped low, around 17%, and there's zero tax on foreign-sourced income brought into Singapore under certain conditions. So if you need global acceptance, stability, and a reputable base for ongoing business, Singapore is a top contender. The trade-off is usually higher setup and compliance costs compared to other jurisdictions.
Right. And finally, Belize.
Belize is kind of the classic accessible offshore jurisdiction. It's been popular for a long time because it offers strong privacy protections, generally lower costs to set up and maintain structures, and it's incredibly fast. You can often get incorporated and set up there in just 24 to 48 hours. So for many people just starting out or those prioritizing speed and cost effectiveness alongside good privacy, Belize is often a great entry point.
Makes sense. But regardless of where you choose, compliance is absolutely key, isn't it? You mentioned KYC. Maybe slow down on those acronyms a bit.
Oh, absolutely critical. Yeah, KYC, Know Your Customer. This isn't optional. It's a global standard, part of anti-money laundering efforts worldwide. Every legitimate offshore provider or bank will require it. It usually breaks down into three parts. First, CIP, customer identification procedures, basically proving you are who you say you are, with passports, utility bills, that sort of thing. Second, CDD, customer due diligence. They need to understand your business, the source of your funds, what you intend to do. And sometimes for higher risk situations, there's EDD, enhanced due diligence, which is just a deeper dive. You absolutely have to take this seriously and be transparent. Trying to hide things here is a recipe for disaster.
Okay. And the final piece of caution on picking a jurisdiction involved those FATF lists.
Correct. The Financial Action Task Force. It's an international body that sets standards. You always need to be aware of their lists. Avoid any dealings with countries on the FATF blacklist. Currently, places like North Korea, Iran, Myanmar. Doing business there can trigger severe penalties back home. And also keep an eye on the gray list. These are countries under increased monitoring, working to fix deficiencies. Currently, that list includes places like the British Virgin Islands, actually, Croatia, UAE. It doesn't mean you can't use them, but it signals increased scrutiny. If reputation and seamless international transactions are vital, you might lean towards higher tier jurisdictions like Singapore or Switzerland that aren't on these lists.
Wow. Okay. This has been quite the journey.
Yeah.
We really went from that Titanic problem, the shaky ground of domestic financial security, and we've navigated through the potential lifeboats, you know, setting up smarter domestic structures, diversifying assets across the globe, and ultimately understanding the power of the Offshore Asset Protection Trust.
Yeah, we covered a lot of ground. And as you, the listener, think about moving forward, it's good to remember the roadmap to offshore success the source lays out. It has 8 steps. But honestly, the first two are maybe the most fundamental. First, really determine your personal comfort level. How much, what percentage of your assets are you realistically prepared to move offshore? And second, develop a solid strategy before you act. A multi-jurisdictional plan likely involving both domestic and offshore elements. Don't just jump in. Plan it out carefully.
Right. Plan the voyage before setting sail. Okay, so here's your homework, building on that final big takeaway. 80% of global financial opportunity lies offshore, and the dollar's value faces ongoing pressure. If you're feeling like Sisyphus, constantly pushing that wealth boulder uphill only to see taxes and liability roll it back down, the knowledge we've unpacked today offers a potential path off that hill. So the question for you to really mull over is this: what's your primary strategic goal? Is it pure, hardcore wealth protection, meeting the fortress-like laws of a place like the Cook Islands? Or is it supporting active international business, requiring the stability and credibility of somewhere like Singapore? Your answer to that will start to dictate the safest, most effective jurisdiction for you. Start thinking about that choice.